Welcome to the Regenerative Rising podcast, Elevating Voices, Activating Change. I'm your guest host, Jesse Dilo, and I'm glad to be back for another episode, and I'm grateful to be joined today by our guest, Wheezy Little Elk. In our conversation today, we're going to explore the dynamics of tribal governments, tribal agriculture, and food production, as well as sovereignty. And I'd like to consider the potential impacts of some of these emerging market-based solutions like regenerative agriculture and what the meaning is for native producers and tribal governments. So we have lots to dig into today. I hope you enjoy the show. I'd first like to introduce you by reading your bio. Our guest today is an enrolled Rosebud Sioux Tribe member and nationally recognized young native leader. Wheezy was with Four Directions when he helped deliver record-breaking levels of native voter turnout in 2004. He later joined Senator Barack Obama's campaign for president as Native American Outreach Coordinator and was promoted to the campaign's national First Americans Vote Director. After a successful campaign, Wheezy was named First Americans Public Liaison for the Obama Transition Team and later became Deputy Chief of Staff to the United States Department of the Interior Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs. In 2011, Wheezy returned home, where he became CEO of the Rosebud Economic Development Corporation. He earned his BA from Yale and his JD in Indian Law from the University of Arizona's James E. Rogers College of Law. Wheezy, thank you for joining me today.
Well, awesome. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. The only other thing, but the most important thing, you kind of read the bio, is I have an amazing, wonderful wife who is the love of my life, and together we have four amazing children. So being a husband and father and good relative is also really, really important to me, more important than everything else.
I love that. I love that you started there too. I was recently asked by somebody, what's your superpower? And I said, I'm a mom, I'm a wife, and I run a business. And if that's not good enough for you, I don't know what is.
We need more moms just running the world, period.
I love it. So, well, I'm happy to jump in today. I wanted to kind of start by acknowledging what is coming up this next Monday. And I know for the recording, this will post after Indigenous Peoples Day. But I'm really proud for the city of Boston to be celebrating our first ever Indigenous Peoples Day and retiring Columbus Day. I would love to kind of get your reaction and what is there meaning to that and what that looks like for you.
I think that, coming from this part of the world and, we're representing, Red Corps and our organization, that language matters and names matter. And what we choose to recognize is really important. And that, overall, I think with kind of the moment that we're in within this country around increased representation, in media and, just kind of in various different areas of Indigenous people it's long overdue. And, often one of the things that I always say is that, when we always have to remember the I for Indigenous and BIPOC, and, we all need to be working in solidarity with one another, various BIPOC kind of groups and organizations and people and working together with our allies, and all of us in some way, shape or form has privilege. And, certainly me, as a male, heterosexual, well-educated, I carry a certain privilege, and there's nothing wrong with privilege. It's how you use that privilege to empower others who may not have an easy life as you. So, for me, I really just think that the people that have kind of pushed these kinds of movements for greater representation and understanding and opportunities for healing, I'm just really thankful to folks. People have been working at this for a long time, way before I ever came around or was born. And so just continuing other people's legacy for, greater justice and fairness in the world is really important.
Yeah, I love how you've presented it like that. It does feel like generally like this is just a very pivotal moment. And I'm curious if you see that as well, whether it's in, you know, kind of a cultural moment, if it's post-pandemic moment, if it's in just kind of climate change and, you know, the future of food systems and agriculture. Do you also have a sense that this is a kind of pivotal moment in our history?
I do. You know, it's really interesting. I remember one of the first classes I took as a freshman. It was called Climate Change, Infectious Disease, and Population Growth. And it literally studied, you know, said, you know, kind of the science and data behind population growth. There's going to be, well, there's X amount of billion people, you know, over the course of history. There's going to be an infectious disease outbreaks. We can predict that. And we know exactly what's going to happen with the climate. And the models that we studied were actually models developed in the 60s. And this was in 1999 when I took the class. And I think what we've seen is that all of those models in many ways like underestimated the impacts and what was going to happen. And especially climate change has happened much faster and at a greater magnitude than was originally predicted. So we've known about this for decades. We've known what was coming around climate change, from population growth. And we knew that there was going to be, you know, some kind of pandemic outbreak of disease, infectious disease at some point. So I think that it kind of highlights the need to really recenter Western-based science. And kind of what we know from that and to say, like the markets, like many other areas, we can predict this stuff with a fair degree of accuracy and then plan for it. At the same time, I also think that it really highlights the need for the recentering and the uplifting of Indigenous knowledge. You know, it was the late 1800s when Chief Sitting Bull, after traveling Europe, you know, said, quote, the white man knows how to make everything, but does not know how to distribute it. And so he was talking about socioeconomic inequity in the 1800s. And, you know, Chief Seattle is said to have famously said, you know, continue to defecate in your own bed and you'll suffocate. And he was talking about the environmental impacts. And he was doing that, you know, in over 100 years ago. So if we kind of continue to follow that thread of Indigenous people and leaders and thinkers, we see a continued and consistent kind of discourse and warning to the rest of society that we need to tackle socioeconomic inequity and climate change. And those are the two greatest challenges facing humanity today. Those are the existential challenges. So Western science has predicted that these challenges were going to be here. And even before the Western models were developed, Indigenous people were talking about this stuff. So I think uplifting and putting primacy to Indigenous knowledge and then having that be informed by Western science is going to be critical to tackling all of these problems, you know, whether it be climate change, pandemic, et cetera. And kind of just one more thing I'd say is, for our own organization, you know, here at REDCO and you know, the work that we do here on the ground, we've always felt that our work was important, you know, uplifting people and creating opportunity and developing regenerative food systems, et cetera. What the pandemic showed us was that our work was not only important, but that it was urgent. You know, so for example, you know, with some of the food systems work that we're doing, and the challenges to the food and supply chain, that if we were where we want to be 10 years from now, if we were here, we're there today, it would have a far less impact on us from a food and supply chain standpoint. That as the rest of the country was experiencing, you know, kind of these shortages, we would have been perfectly fine. And so basically what it told us is we need to accelerate our work because it's urgent.
Yeah. Yeah. So much in that response, you know, environmental justice, you know, the way we think about science, the way we integrate different kinds of points of views and, you know, cultural and pragmatic and policy. And then I absolutely want to dig in agriculture and food systems because that's my jam. But I'm really curious because I'm hearing environmental justice kind of thrown around a lot, especially in the context of regenerative. And I'm wondering if you believe that we have a really good way of understanding that problem yet. Have we heard from the voices that are most affected by this enough that we can apply that kind of integrated approach that you described of Western science with indigenous knowledge and kind of merging these two capabilities to come up with a truly equitable solution?
Well, I think that the voices have been out there for a long time. And I think the question is have people been listening? And I think that people are starting to more listen a little bit more kind of through this moment. And I think that one of the things that we really need to do is to, you know, in all ways, shapes, or forms, is to begin including those voices kind of around what we need to be doing and what the opportunities are. You know, kind of here with us, we have a very specific framework in how we approach our work. And for us, we call that Wichunchage Shakowi, which means seven generations. And for short, we call it seven gen. And for us, it's a prophecy that there will be a period of decline followed by a period or a generation of uplift that's uplifted and informed and enlightened and prosperous. And so we absolutely 100% know that our best days are ahead of us and not behind us. And so it's an inevitability that we're going to have a strong and prosperous future. It is also a duty. The my tribe, the Rosebud Sioux tribe, it's written into our constitution that we are supposed to consider the implications of our decisions on the next seven generations. So it's actually a constitutional duty that we're to think seven generations out. And then finally, we'd say that it's a process. And for us, that process has three parts to it. First, always act in the best interest of your great-grandchildren's great-grandchildren. And that if we do that, we're going to make really good decisions. Second, always make moral and ethical decisions that place the good of the group above the good of the individual. And that if we stick to our morals and our ethics and we look at the greater good, we're going to be in a really strong place. From a Western perspective, you know, we might call that avoiding the tragedy of the commons. And then finally, embrace complex systems thinking. Indigenous thought and philosophy has always been systemic in nature. And look, and as a part of that, we must place primacy of indigenous knowledge above all else to be informed by Western science. That when we do that, we're going to have all of the data and information to make really good decisions. And if we do all three of those, we can solve climate change. We can solve socioeconomic inequity. We can create a better world for all people. And that process, while I think is kind of pioneered or really the torch has been carried by indigenous people, is something that every single person on the planet can embrace as well in their own unique way. So, you know, I think sometimes we kind of think about the past, but really like what we're looking at is the future and how we can do this. Another thing I think is kind of important to add is, from an indigenous perspective, regenerative agriculture is not new to, you know, and really I think that what's most important is what we would say is that it has to be indigenous agriculture, because regenerative agriculture is really just indigenous practices informed by the latest and greatest of Western science. I think getting back to those roots, getting back to this idea that we can build soil health, and, you know, just kind of rejecting the notion that we only have, you know, 59 growing seasons left ahead of us. No, we can have infinite growing seasons ahead of us as long as we do things correctly. And really just go back to the kind of indigenous agricultural practices. I was, you know, a friend of mine, he was talking about a variety of corn that he planted this year in Arizona, in the middle of a drought. And he's like, I'm using 3,000-year-old variety of his tribe's corn. That was big and it was lush. And, you know, he's like, we have to do things a little bit different, but, you know, we've been doing this for thousands of years. So this idea that, you know, that we only have a limited amount of time left is just kind of false. Like, we're going to be here for a while.
Yeah, I really appreciate the way you describe that, like, prophecy, duty, process, systems thinking, and then really focus on the future. Because I have a really hard time with that, like, pessimistic view of 60 harvests left and we're done. Yeah, I think it's just, I mean, perfectly captures what Western culture is all about. It's all about me right now here in this moment. And we really have failed to kind of see the big picture. Like, we are part of a giant ecosystem and machine and energy source that was here before us, and it will live way beyond us. And I think one of the most encouraging things that I saw and read about recently was following the Australian wildfires. There was a bloom of, I think it was phytoplankton or some algae. And that algae in the ocean captured an equivalent amount of CO2 that was released in the wildfires. Hmm. And that was that moment. And, you know, don't quote me on this, but those are those things where, like, I know my earth will be okay. Will my people be okay? And I think it's really interesting to hear you kind of speak about regenerative ag in this way. And I'm wondering if you can kind of ground it in, you know, something that you were doing either, you know, at Rosebud or that you're seeing elsewhere. Like, what examples are out there that are really inspiring to you right now?
Well, I want to say one more thing kind of along that line and then jump into an example. But one of the things that made me think about is, I talked to one of my uncles, I don't know, several months ago, and he's an older individual who's a kind of cultural expert and leader, and he's an elder. And I asked him, I said, you know, uncle, you know, like, what's your advice about the pandemic? And he said, okay, well, he said, nephew, he said, in the 1980s, he said, there was a group of environmental leaders who came out to Rosebud, who wanted to meet with our spiritual leaders because they wanted to talk with them about, you know, kind of this kind of big, broad environmental work that they wanted to do. And so they sat down with them and told them that they said, well, really, you don't really need to worry about the earth. What you need to worry about is treating people good. I said, the earth, she's been around for a long time and she has energy and she knows how to heal herself. And that if we as humans can tap into that energy that she has, that healing energy. But that, you know, when we wear rubber-soled shoes, that kind of interrupts that. And so that really, if we want to do good in the world, like, let's not really worry about the earth. Let's worry about treating each other good. And then if we do that, if we just treat each other good, then that's going to open the doorway so that we can be a part of the earth's overall healing process.
Yeah.
And so he said, what we should do with the pandemic is we need to make sure that we treat each other good, make sure that we're connected, and that the earth is that she's going to heal herself. And that in doing that, by not treating each other bad, that we're going to begin the process of stopping to harming the earth. And that this idea that socioeconomic equity and climate change and environmental issues, they're all one and the same. They're tied together. And we just need to concentrate on being good to each other. And through that, we're going to end up being good to the planet. And I think that that idea has been really integrated into a lot of the work that we do here in with REDCO and our organization here in Rosebud. And one of those projects that we get really excited about and that we've had a lot of success with is the Wulakota Regenerative Buffalo Range, and which is a 28,000 acre buffalo range that will be home to 1,500 buffalo and be able to produce between 300 and 400 surplus animals a year that we can harvest. And this is one of those projects, businesses that really leans into kind of how we define wealth and in kind of this new way of thinking about the world that's starting to emerge around businesses having multiple bottom lines. Yes, it will have a small profit and it will be financially sustainable. But the environmental impacts that it has are large and significant. The social impacts that it has and is having is also significant, as well as, you know, components of justice and tribal nation building as well, that it has direct kind of measurable impacts there. So this idea that we can have multiple bottom line businesses is that's indigenous, and we're kind of waiting for the rest of the world to kind of catch up from that perspective, I think. I want to talk a little bit about like Wulakota and what that means, right? So Wulakota really means to live the Lakota way of life, and the word Lakota means to be ally. And so what it means is to be living in a way where you are an ally. And for us, we believe that we're related to everybody and everything, and that it's not just being related to other humans, but that we have relationships with the rest of the universe. So for us, to treat each other good also means to treat the rest of creation good and in a respectful way that honors relationship protocols. And so for us to raise buffalo and to bring buffalo back like this, there's nothing more natural. Just as we as Lakota need to have a home, buffalo need to have a home where they can be buffalo and be their fullest and authentic selves too. So.
Yeah, I really love kind of how you started that response by looking at the human component and you know, that the earth can heal itself, but our real challenge is the social and economic conditions that we're managing through. And I feel like for the pandemic, I think, yeah, we can talk about supply chains. I mean, talk about, you know, cargo ships stuck in the Suez Canal and all of that. But, you know, what I think to me is where we should be focusing our attention is, have we taken care of people? I mean, we have a labor shortage, and we just keep talking about this labor shortage in terms of the economics, but we're not talking about, like, where are all these people? Why won't they come back? And $15 minimum wage, that's still not enough. I mean, I don't understand the whole picture, you know, but I think it's really fascinating to watch the way we're talking about labor as an economic widget in a broader system. And again, we have kind of devalued the human and in this world. And I think it's just a really fascinating place that we can do a better job in the way we talk about it, to incorporate, you know, the challenges that we're facing in a supply chain, a very hard and fast labor market, which we can quantify, but then how do we qualify that to guide a discussion and a change strategy?
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that, all of that, and you know, our organization, like a long time ago, we made the internal commitment that our minimum wage was going to be set at $15 an hour, just because it was the right thing to do, because gas is expensive and you know, hamburgers is expensive and bread, like just to be able to live, like you, it's difficult for people to live on less than that. So we did that as an organization a while back, and you know, we offer a full suite of, you know, healthcare benefits, etc., and really try to focus on organizational culture. But I think what the root of what you're talking about is you know, this idea that from a Western perspective, you know, wealth is measured and wealth is defined as labor plus capital of some kind, some kind of input, whether it be a natural resource or financial resource, et cetera, equals wealth, right? Labor plus capital equals wealth. I think from a Lakota perspective, we would say that relatives plus respectful ritual relationships with those relatives equals wealth. Because at the end of the day, you know, like, you know, we, from our perspective, there's a world that exists outside of us, and that, you know, when we're finished with our human journey, we're going to continue a spiritual journey. You don't get to take your credit card with you. You don't get to, you know, you're not taking something like, you know, the physical wealth with you. What you are taking is the relationships that you've had with people, and you're leaving behind a legacy that is about people and your relatives. And that's what real wealth is. So I think refocusing, you know, definitions of wealth that put the heart of humanity at the center is what's important. And as a species, we're smart, we're ingenious people, and we're going to figure out the numbers and how we put bread on the table, and all of that. We're you know, we've been around for thousands of years. We're going to figure that stuff out. But the most important thing is putting humanity, you know, in the human heart back at the center.
So I want to go back to the buffalo, because you threw some numbers out: 28,000 acres, 1,500 buffalo, 300 to 400 for sale. Help us understand a little bit more about how you get to that, you know, divide of 1,500 for, you know, for the, is it the community, and then 300 to 400 for the sale? And how is that different than what, you know, a Western farmer might be approaching that?
Yeah. So I think that, I mean, we're, you know, our organization, we love numbers. Might be kind of weird, but I love spreadsheets. You know, we always, you know, dig into the numbers, and before we do anything, you know, try to use all the knowledge available to us. That's indigenous. Like, that's indigenous thinking. If there's a tool to use that tool. And if it can help you make a better decision, incorporate it. So, when we did a very comprehensive feasibility study on this particular piece of land, which is, you know, 28,000 contiguous acres, you know, we looked at the carrying capacity. It's actually over 1,500, but we've done everything to a drought year. So again, when we do things, we always try to be conservative. That's kind of how we do business. And said, okay, this is what the carrying capacity is, to raise these animals in a healthy way that is going to not damage the environment, not damage the soil or the landscape, but that will actually enhance and strengthen that landscape, using buffalo as a keystone species, as kind of larger prairie ecosystem regeneration, and to increase the overall biodiversity, both from an animal standpoint, from an insect standpoint, a plant insect standpoint, and from a microbiological standpoint with the soil. And so taking all of that information and data, you know, that's how we, you know, said came to kind of a carrying capacity. And from there, then we just built a business plan. You know, here's how many animals we can produce. I guess one thing I would also say is, you know, those numbers are also based on a more of a natural herd size, as opposed to an artificial herd size that has the you know, kind of an artificial ratio of male to female. That each herds, each kind of species has its own natural male to female ratio. And so we have a more natural male to female ratio there. And, you know, so letting them be natural, from that perspective. Also, that we come to that number from because it's not also necessarily a maximization of production. Because in kind of a standard approach, you maximize production and you are going to kill every single animal. Our way of doing things ensures that some of the animals live to old age and, you know, pass from natural causes, because that's how it would be in nature. Because also at the same time, buffalo have their own culture and they have their own society. And, you know, you can think about other herd animals or, you know, people that have studied wolves, you know, and they got their own, you know, kind of alpha wolf and, you know, just this whole social hierarchy. Well, buffalo are the same. They have a way of organizing themselves and a way of passing on knowledge. And interestingly enough, buffalo are actually a matriarchal society. You know, everyone always kind of looks at buffalo and like, oh, you got this big herd bull. Well, it's actually those grandmother buffaloes that run the herd and keeps everybody in line. And that's how our society is. You know, when grandmas or auntie says do something, you know, all the nephews, we have to get in line and do it. and so the herd bulls, they're protectors. You know, they're to make sure that the calves don't get hurt. And So to raise buffalo like that is a little bit different. You're not just maximizing profit there. At the same time, one of the things that we're very adamant about is that our buffalo will always be field harvested with all of the proper prayer and cultural protocol attached. And that when we do so, that we purposefully use every part of the animal. Gratefulness, gratitude is incredibly important, because if you're going to take a life, then no part should be wasted. And for us, if we do that, then if we use every part of the animal, we remain grateful, and that we do so with prayer, then it's a good thing to take the animal. It's a good thing to use their meat and to process the animal. That means that our buffalo will never see a feedlot, and, you know, we'll never just, you know, kind of get into like a large scale kind of slaughtering of them. Because at that point we're not treating them like buffalo. And that's one of our rules, is treat buffalo like buffalo.
Mm-hmm. There's so many detailed questions I want to ask. I think I want to first start with the land base. Is that 28,000 acres tribal land and under your control?
Yeah. So this land actually has a really interesting history. So obviously, you know, like many other Indian reservations, the reservation was allotted. And so for the allotment acts that impacted us, basically, you know, we were, you know, put on a reservation, and in every male head of household was assigned 160 acres. Every unmarried male of adult age was, you know, quote, given 80 acres. And the rest of the land was then allotted and basically sold on pennies for the dollar to non-Indian allottees. And through that process, Rosebud, like many other tribes, lost millions of acres of land. Rosebud in the 1940s created an organization called Tribal Land Enterprise, and it was a corporation that's a shareholder corporation in which the tribal government itself is the largest shareholder, but individuals can also own shares in the corporation, and they don't have to be a tribal member. We have Class A and Class B shares, so I can own, as a tribal member, can own Class A shares, which allows me to vote. But, you know, you as a non-tribal member, you could also own Class B shares in the corporation. And this corporation was formed in order to purchase land ownership interests from individuals who wanted to you know, get rid of, you know, sell their land because of fractionation issues. So, you know, land, because of the kind of the systems of the place, became highly fractionated. So you might have 30, 40, 100 plus owners on a piece, one piece of land, which would, you know, render it useless, because you have to get majority of the individuals to agree on how to use the land. By TLE purchasing those, they were then able to consolidate ownership under tribal control. At the same time, it's really, really unique because if I own shares in that TLE shares, I can look at land that TLE owns and assign my shares to a piece of land equal to the dollar value of that land. So if 1 acre was $1,000 and I have $1,000 worth of shares, I can apply it to that piece of land and get all the use rights. And if that is land is taken from me via eminent domain, I have to be fairly compensated. Or at any point, I can sell my shares back to TLE or unassign the land. And so it allows for people to have individual use rights of land while at the same time building the tribe's land base and keeping it under tribal control and jurisdiction. You know, it really was, you know, kind of one of these really innovative organizations, I think, that is, you know, kind of at the forefront and was kind of doing land trust kind of activities way before kind of land trust become popular. So the other thing that TLE does is it's in the business of purchasing and buying back stolen land, land that, that was just taken from us. And so TLE, you know, this particular piece of land was an allotment, and TLE bought the land and then put it into federal trust. And then they own the land and they've leased it out. And when we started the project, we worked with them and they provided a really great long-term lease to us. And so, you know, we as a tribal corporation are leasing the land from another tribal corporation to run this herd. And, you know, right away, we always get people who are like, well, why are you having to lease the land? Why don't they just give it to you for free? Well, TLE has to buy land, and the financial dividend that TLE pays to its shareholders, and the largest of which is the Rosebud Sioux Tribe, directly funds essential governmental services like healthcare and education. So the tribal government needs to be able to function. Plus, TLE needs to continue its operation of buying back land and putting it back under tribal control. And that's why we have to pay a lease. That's why it's a good thing for us to pay a lease on this. But they've been incredible partners with us on this. So that's kind of a long answer.
No, it's a really important context, though, because I don't think anybody understands the dynamics at play here. You know, I think we just like, kind of couch like tribal land and, you know, American land, right? Air quotes for people who are just listening. and when you get into the details of, well, I want to take out a loan. Well, you don't own that land, so you don't get to take collateral against it. Or I'd like to see a change in this space. Okay, there's tribal government, there's tribal producer associations, there's individual tribal producers, and there's Anglo producers on tribal rented land. And so it's not a very straightforward, you know, process. So I thank you for kind of describing that and how important it is to, as a kind of that full circle and self-perpetuating cycle of building wealth back. And I'm curious, you kind of touched on a little bit about kind of internal alignment and the human dynamics. Are there conflicts that you've had to overcome? Is this always easy? Is everyone agree on the path forward? What has that process looked like for you as a leader at Rosebud to kind of initiate this effort and kind of bring everyone along for that journey?
I think that one of the things I always talk about is a lot of the stuff that we're doing, you know, here at Redco is not new. It's not a new idea. People have been talking about this for a long time. We're just, you know, privileged enough to be in a position where we can execute on ideas that have been around. And so there's always been talk about, you know, kind of expanding and having a much larger buffalo herd, and that we, you know, creating opportunities to harvest buffalo. And so we're just executing on that idea, and we're not the first people to even start a herd in Rosebud. You know, there's been a lot of work that was done in the 80s, and so we're just continuing that work that's been done here in Rosebud and across the country. But you kind of, you know, thinking about it, from any challenges, the challenge is always, you know, not necessarily the idea, but getting everyone to come together to do the work, right? And because nothing is easy. And building consensus on the particulars of something is where the work happens. Everyone loves this concept, loves these ideas. It's just getting everyone to be able to like focus on the details and execute on it. But I think that one of the great things about this work is it's meaningful for the community. But I also think that we have an opportunity to develop and create a new way of bringing more buffalo back. And, you know, for this particular project, like we've always defined success as somebody else doing an even bigger, more awesome buffalo herd than us. Like for us, that's success. When somebody else says, well, you know what, you guys used to have the largest Native American owned and managed buffalo herd in the world. Now us over here, we have that. That's success. That's what we want to see.
I love that. And I think a really key component of that is bringing young people back and getting young people interested in agriculture and animal husbandry. Can you talk about kind of the efforts that are in place or the challenges you're facing? What does that look like?
So everything is an ecosystem. And, you know, I didn't talk too much about this, but, you know, REDCO is a economic development corporation owned by the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. And it has for-profit subsidiary businesses that do business on and off the reservation in a variety of ways and in a variety of sectors. Also, we have a nonprofit entity, 501c3 entity, which we call Sichagu CDC. And we have an emerging community development financial institution. And REDCO also engages in policy, you know, kind of work, especially at the tribal level, being able to assist the tribe in developing and writing and drafting laws and policies. So, you know, kind of within that, all of that, what we're talking about is bringing business, community development, and, you know, kind of individual wealth building and policy all together, all under one roof. And so with shared vision and management, that's kind of what what our ecosystem of organizations is and does. When doing that, what that allows us to do is to have some like real authentic integration and cross-pollinization. And so, yeah, we have a cool buffalo herd and it's growing and expanding, doing all kinds of great stuff for the environment. But we also started a Lakota language immersion school as one of our community development initiatives. So we started with a class of kindergartners last year. This year we have kindergartners and first graders. And just yesterday, the school was out at the buffalo herd, seeing the buffalo, learning about them. And so now all of a sudden you have these little kids, these little guys directly interacting and developing a relationship with buffalo. And so that becomes a part of their reality. And I was talking to the herd manager and assistant manager. I was like, hopefully one of those kids is going to be your replacement someday. And for us, like, you know, they're able to do the cultural learning, but, you know, also like scientific and science learning, you know, age appropriate for kindergartners and first graders. But, you know, their project this semester is around buffalo. And where else do you get to do that? You know, you have like this actual business that's kind of a new generation of business that's healing the land with these magical social returns. Like you can never quantify the impact of a 6-year-old getting to go and see buffalo firsthand and connect with them. That's where the magic is. That's where really amazing things can happen. And we want to do that kind of work, but just multiply it and continue to grow that.
Yeah, that field trip sounds way cooler than the one I took when I was 6 years old. So very, very cool. What is inspiring you right now as you think about the crisis of climate change and the potential impacts, you know, on agricultural systems, food systems, human systems? What keeps you going and inspires you to get to work every day on these big problems?
So I think I have a lot of inspirations, but one of the things that I always keep with me is that this idea that our best days are ahead of us, they're not behind us. And that no matter how gloomy things can seem, we always have to move forward with that in our heart. And that we have these incredible young people, these incredible children that are going to do things that we can't even imagine, that they're going to invent things that we can't even imagine. And our job is to steward things and have a good handoff for them. And when the time is right, to get out of their way, right? To not hold them back. And I think that, like, overall, like I think that's what gets me really excited. I also just love and you know, sometimes I'm a little bit pushy with this idea, this concept that indigenous knowledge, it's time for indigenous knowledge and life ways to rise to the forefront and to begin taking some primacy in these discussions. Because we've had the solutions for a long time, and it's now time to listen and to begin implementing those solutions. You know, we look at the buffalo work that we're doing, and I can only imagine the impact of what 10,000 more Mula Kota type projects would have on the planet. And it doesn't have to be buffalo. It has to be whatever is going to be unique to that particular environment. But we can do it. You know, one thing I would add is we're talking about doing what, you know, and implementing one of the world's, you know, most innovative and leading social impact investment projects in the third poorest county in the United States. And if we can do that in the third poorest county in the United States, what's holding us back from doing it everywhere else? Like we can do this. We as a species, as humanity, we can get this done. And that's what I'm excited about. That's what gets me fired up.
Nice. I love that energy. Yeah, was there, like, we don't know each other super well, but, you know, most people would say I'm a little bit more on the cynical side. But the thing that I get read recently, which should have been like a real downturn, you know, for me, of hearing by 2100, we should expect 6 months of summer, 2 months of winter, and very short and intensive kind of transitional seasons in spring and fall. And, you know, I'm deep in working on these regenerative ag systems and how do we create production systems and supply chains and all that. And seeing that we had a potential of 6 months of summer, yeah, there's a lot that's kind of scary about that, but I was mostly excited. I was like, imagine if we are thinking about developing production systems that are in line with nature, that are capturing the value of nature. How do we get more crops out of a 6 month summer? This is going to be a major benefit to solving food security and nutritional problems. Like, there's so much more we can do with a longer summer in Boston, in New England, in the northern climates. It does at the same time give me major pause about what's going to happen to the southern part of the United States and Mexico and Central America, et cetera. But I was looking at some of these indigenous farming systems in Arizona. And like you mentioned, with the 3,000 year old, you know, grain variety, like, we can absolutely do this if we can dig deeper into our kind of knowledge base and bring in the value and the knowledge that people who have been here for tens of thousands of years can help us kind of craft these systems with, like, modern technology and production and relationships. So I am also really inspired by what's possible. And I believe that 2050 will be a world that was unimaginable when I was born. And it's going to be fascinating to see how rapidly we innovate and unleash our young people into solving these big problems, because I am so thrilled about what I see in young people. The way they talk about each other, how quickly they can adapt to these cultural shifts. It's inspiring and it's hopeful. And I think if that's the way that folks are looking at it from a young age, it does feel like anything is possible as we have more and more challenges facing us every year.
I agree in a lot of ways. And I think like looking back at our history is really important, because we've survived some pretty tough challenges. And, here we are in the pandemic, and, we're talking about the challenges of the pandemic. And my mother reminded me, she said, your grandmother was born in 1816. I'm sorry, not 18, 1916. So she was 2 years old when the Spanish flu epidemic hit us. And she said that your grandmother was taken by her parents, and they went and moved out into the middle of the country and quarantined for 2 years, living in a canvas army tent. And so you want to talk about social distancing, like that is social distancing. But the family, pulled through it and survived it. And so she said, this isn't our first pandemic, as Indigenous people, just as a family, we've gone through this before. So we need to take courage and know that we have a legacy of survival. All within that, we have to figure out how we're going to keep it under 4 degrees warming. So we don't, there's things we got to act now, but there's a rich history of resilience that we can pull from.
Yep, I agree. And I think that if we could, kind of look at some of these like market-based solutions for regenerative ag and climate change and start to soften the kind of economic standpoint of it and really do a better job of integrating the social and the human components of this, we're going to have a better chance of success, because markets do not solve humanity's problems. Markets are really good for driving down price and driving up productivity and efficiency. And that plays a really important role. But when I keep thinking about the challenge that we have in front of us, it is about people and innovators and just thoughtfulness and staying connected to each other and being open-minded.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I'd love your closing thoughts. Like, what are you looking at this next year? What's this month hold for you? Kind of help us see a little bit more into what you're going to be working on.
So one of the things that I think is really exciting for the organization is continuing the food and agricultural ecosystem work. When we talk about the ecosystem work, we're really talking about several things. One is, I didn't even talk about this, but we have a 7-gen plan, which is a 175-year plan of prosperity for our people and region. And in that plan, we're just asking some really basic questions. Where are we going to live? How many of us are there going to be? What languages are we going to speak? What will our health and education systems look like? Where will our food come from? What will our relationship with technology be? When we first started the plan, I used to say, should we have a Lakota colony on Mars? And people would just laugh. But I'm like, wow, so you guys know there's people planning this. Like, at some point, we're going to have to make that decision, right? Like, so those are big questions that we're answering for our own people and our society. And I don't think that the ultimate answers are so important as opposed to the fact that we're asking those questions and moving in a direction. The generation after me is going to move in a different direction and according to their priorities. And that's cool. That's great. So as a part of this 7-Gen plan, we here have identified that we want to become a food hub, that, you know, we want to be food sovereign and have the ability to not only feed ourselves, but to become a food exporter and you know, kind of supporter of the food in the region. And so we talked a lot about our Buffalo project, but that's only one component of a much larger framework. So we also right now farm 1,800 acres of organic farm production. I think that we're going to see that grow and expand, and that we're going to begin the process of going from just kind of a producer to value added production. And, you know, we have a plan for a meat processing facility. We want to look at value add on the farming side. What can we grow and produce that we can then turn into something that's going to be useful for us? And that happens at the macro scale. We also have worked through our food sovereignty initiative at the micro scale. And that's about working with individuals and families, the community. The Food Sovereignty Initiative runs a farmers market. They have a fellowship program where they're working with individuals to help them learn how to grow and produce their own food. They will get a business grant at the end to help start their own small business. We have a community greenhouse and teaching garden. We got a banana tree growing in our greenhouse, and you know, here it is, like South Dakota, below zero weather, we got a banana tree. You know, and then I think that the next, and so that's really, that work is really strong. I think the next piece that we're going to look at, you know, down the road is, what kind of intermediary level work can we do around the development of co-ops and, you know, other ways that people and individuals and families can not only produce enough food for themselves, but can we create markets for them to put their food processing systems in? And so we have just an amazing team of people who are doing that work. And I'm just excited to see what they're going to do and develop and produce over the next few years.
I love it. That's super exciting. And I'm kind of on a parallel journey in my own career, because I think you have nailed this. It is about the hub. It's about innovation at that hub. It's about value add and a training center and all of those really cool components. How do people outside the community become allies in this work? How do we support, you know, this really exciting work? Because it sounds like this is something that should be replicated, you know, just like the Buffalo operations all over, but tailored to the, you know, the place. Yeah. How do people provide support?
So I think that, you know, one of the big questions, especially now in this moment, is, you know, allyship. I always think the first thing is, you know, if you're in a position of privilege and you want to be an ally, the first thing is to listen and listen to those communities and what are they saying? And what is the advice that they're giving? We should never, come in and presume anything. And so the first thing is listening. And what are people asking you to do? The second is amplification, amplifying the message. Whatever that message is for that community, amplify that message. And so for us, you know, amplification of 7-Gen, amplification of the uplifting of Indigenous voices and solutions to climate change and socioeconomic inequity, uplift those voices. And then the third is action. What is the kind of action that you can take as an individual, as a leader within a nonprofit or a business or a family trust? What is the action that you can take? And if you're a person of big privilege, if you're a CEO or you know, somebody who really has a big say, use that power to listen and to amplify and then take action. Because we can't ever, we can't do more than we're capable of as an individual or a business or whatever, but we can all do something that's appropriate to our ability. And so I think that if you do those three things, listen, amplify, and act, we can just uplift everybody. And that is incumbent upon all of us, because we all are bringing privilege of some kind. So let's use that privilege to really uplift people.
I love it. I don't want to say anything else, because I think that is the perfect place to stop. Listen, amplify, and act. Thank you. Thank you so much for your time today. I really enjoyed the conversation. I enjoyed hearing your story and getting to know you better. And so I shall wrap this up. So thank you again for joining us for this episode of the Regenerative Rising podcast, Elevating Voices, Activating Change. It was a real honor to be with you, Weezy. Thank you.
Awesome. Appreciate it.